vine and bull. It's talking about two different things here in Hosea chapter 10. We're going to be looking at verses 1 through 8. Remember, there are five judgment salvation cycles throughout the prophecy. We're continuing in the fourth one of these. It runs from chapter 6, verse 4, to chapter 11, verse 11. We're in chapter 10, just beginning chapter 10 tonight. In our passage this afternoon, God, in verses 1 through 4, condemns Israel's sin, using the figure of Israel as the vine. There's the word vine. And then in verses 5 through 8, the text focuses on the idolatrous bull image in Bethel, the calf, the bull image in Bethel. And so we see those two segments in Hosea 10, verses 1 through 8, hence our title tonight. Let's look at and read verses 1 through 8 of chapter 10 of the book of Hosea. Israel is a luxuriant vine. He produces fruit for himself. The more his fruit, the more altars he made. The richer his land, the better he made the sacred pillars. Their heart is faithless. Now they must bear their guilt. The Lord will break down their altars and destroy their sacred pillars. Surely now they will say, "We have no king, for we do not revere the Lord. As for the king, what can he do for us?" They speak mere words with worthless oaths. They make covenants, and judgment sprouts like poisonous weeds in the furrows of the field. The inhabitants of Samaria will fear for the calf of Bethaven. Indeed, the people will mourn for it, and its idolatrous priests will cry out over it, over its glory, since it has departed from it. The thing itself will be carried to Assyria as tribute to King Jareb. Ephraim will be seized with shame, and Israel will be ashamed of its own counsel. Samaria will be cut off with her king like a stick on the surface of the water. Also the high places of Avon, the sin of Israel, will be destroyed. Thorn and thistle will grow on their altars. They will say to the mountains, "Cover us," and to the hills, "Fall on us." So we see then in verses 1 through 4 the figure of the vine. We see here an agricultural metaphor, and it's used again because we've seen it already in chapter 9 and verse 10. Notice what that verse says. "I found Israel like grapes in the wilderness. I saw your forefathers as the earliest fruit on the fig tree in its first season." So he's used an agricultural metaphor before, and once again, he's using it again. And this time, he's saying that Israel is a luxuriant vine. In other words, they were planted, they were blessed, they were growing luxuriantly, this vine was made fruitful and prosperous by God. So there's a luxuriant vine. This is what God had done for Israel. And notice he produces fruit for himself. God made Israel fruitful and prosperous. And of course, they didn't recognize it was God who did this. Instead, they credited Baal for all of this. And that's what he's saying here in the rest of the verse. The more his fruit, in other words, the more that was produced, the more that God made Israel fruitful, the more that God made Israel prosperous, the more altars he made, the more Israel built pagan altars. So God increases the fruitfulness of the land, and they just keep going with more and more pagan altars. The richer his land, the better he made the sacred pillars. Instead of thanking God for her fertility, she worshiped Baal all the more and built these sacred shrines. By the way, these sacred pillars, these shrines, were mentioned in chapter 3 and verse 4 before. So God's people attributed their prosperity to Baal, not to God. Shame on them for that. So often we may not credit Baal for our prosperity, but many times we credit ourselves, don't we? If we're doing well, you know, it's because of my smarts. It's because, you know, I'm pretty good, instead of crediting God for it. Look, folks, we're nothing without God. Anything we do is only of Him. And we can't, you know, pat ourselves on the back and say, boy, I'm real proud of me. I'm such a great person. Look, if God hadn't given us the strength to do it, we wouldn't have done it. God hadn't given us the ability to make money or whatever it is, then we wouldn't do it. So it's all of God. And yes, a different relationship than Israel had with God, but all the same, the prosperity in our own lives is we need to credit to God, not to us. And often we do. By the way, we are prosperous. Even the poorest of us, we are still prosperous compared to many people in this world of ours. Notice verse 2, their heart is faithless. The word means smooth or flattering. Their heart is smooth. In the Old Testament, it mentions lips and tongues, and they're often spoken of as being smooth. What would be, do you think, a smooth tongue? What does that mean? What's that? Yeah, a liar's part of it. Definitely a liar. Kind of a, you say that someone's slick. What do we mean when we say someone's slick? Oh, they're...
Good negotiator.
Well, they might be, but what does that mean when someone, man, that guy is sneaky.
He can work things out to his favor.
Yeah, yeah. And because he is insincere. He's an insincere person. So, you know, in the Old Testament, the lips and the tongue are called smooth in the sense that these people are insincere. So here we have the people's hearts here are called insincere, or our translation says faithless, which is good. They're insincere, they're faithless, their hearts are. They're deceitful. Because obviously an individual who is insincere is a liar. He's deceitful. A flattering person, a smooth-tongued person. In fact, the book of Proverbs calls that individual smooth-tongued the flatterer. A flattering person is nothing more than a liar. He's a deceiver. So in verse 2 here, it speaks of a deceitful heart. Their heart is faithless or deceitful. They must bear their guilt. The Lord will break down their altars. See, they built up the altars. It was great. But God says, I'm going to break them down. I'm going to bust them. I'm going to break them all down. And when would he do that? It would literally happen. Because Assyria was going to come in and they were going to take them, they were going to attack them, and they were going to take them captive. So the Lord will break down their altars and destroy their sacred pillars. So remember now, verse 1, they had built these altars to Baal. They had built these sacred pillars, these idol-type things to Baal. And to worship Baal. And God says, I'm going to break them all down. Verse 3. Surely now they will say, we have no king. Israel is not going to have a king as a result of the coming invasion. Notice verse 7. Samaria will be cut off with her king. Verse 15. Thus it will be done to you at Bethel because of your great wickedness. At dawn, the king of Israel will be completely cut off. So the text goes on to talk more about the king being cut off. So the idea, surely now they will say we have no king. We have no king. Why? Well, because Assyria was going to come in. They were going to attack them. They were going to take them captive. Indeed, literally, they would have no king. For we do not revere the Lord. Well, they're going to have a realization here. They'll finally come to the realization why this had happened. But frankly, it's too late. They're carried captivity. They're carried into captivity. For we do not revere the Lord. You know what a horrible thing it is not to revere the Lord. You know, the Bible tells us that the fear of the Lord is the beginning. We mentioned this morning. Fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. And that kind of fear is not being afraid of God all the time. I don't think the intent is that we're supposed to walk around 24/7 being afraid of God, that he's going to knock us over the head, you know, with a baseball bat up in heaven. He's watching us. Go on, just do something wrong so I can knock you up alongside the head. I think some people believe that's who our God is. That all he wants to do is judge us and you know, make us unhappy and you know, give us a life that is terrible. That's not who God is. He loves us. Does he judge sin? Of course he does. But he rewards righteousness too. And is this life going to be easy for Christians? No. In fact, God told us plainly, all those who live godly in Christ Jesus will suffer persecution. So not only are you going to have problems, but people are not going to like you either. They didn't like Jesus either. But the fact is, we are to fear God. We are to have an awe and a respect for God. It is that awe that that reveres him as the great God of heaven. It is that awe that prevents us from wanting to sin against him because we have too much reverence, too much respect for God. This is what we need. But the problem was, and they understood it, we have no king because we don't revere God. We don't revere the real king. Does idolatry revere the Lord? Hardly. Just the opposite. It was blasphemy against God. So their whole problem is they didn't revere God. They didn't have a fear of God. They didn't have a reverence of God. They didn't have an awe of God. You see, an awe of God would prevent them from sinning. What do you think it might do for us? We need an awe of God. We need to stand in awe of who he is. Because, yes, it will prevent us from doing what's wrong as well. Now, is there some respect for God in the sense that he will judge us? And in that sense, can there be some fear along those lines? Well, of course. We should be afraid if we do wrong, if we live in sin. Because, yeah, God's going to judge us. But the fact is that our God is not one that just, you know, wants to judge us and, you know, looks for an opportunity to do so. But they understood, at least they didn't fear God, but it was obviously too late. As for the king, what can he do for us? Well, exactly, it was too late anyhow. As for the king, what can he do for us? Nothing. Number one, because he's a human king, but number two, it's too late. Look at chapter 13 and verse 10. Where now is your king that he may save you and all your cities and your judges of whom you requested, give me a king and princes? Remember, Israel begged God in 1 Samuel. We want a king just like everybody else does. Now, I think plainly God had intended on giving them a king. That king was David. I think David should have been their first king. But they insisted, and God gave them Saul. He was the good-looking one. He was the tall one, head and shoulders above everybody else. He was the one that they'd look at and say, wow, this guy's a leader. This is a guy we can follow. But suddenly they've realized, what is a king going to do for us? We want a king just like everybody else to lead us in battle. But they came to a realization that not even a king could help them at this point. Surely now they will say, we have no king. And why? We don't revere the Lord. As for the king, what can he do for us? Verse 4. They speak mere words with worthless oaths. They speak mere words with worthless oaths. They make covenants. The idea of the slippery heart here, the deceitful heart, is expanded on. How is the heart slippery? How is the heart deceitful here? Well, they speak mere words. Ever known people like that? They just speak mere words. Can't trust a thing they say. They just bloviate and blah, 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 blah. It's just mere words. Worthless oaths. I promise you. With worthless oaths, they make covenants. God, we will follow you. You know, we won't do this ever again. How many times did Israel say that? And how many times did they go right back into their sin again? How many times was there a revival and then boom, right back down into sin again? How many times did they promise they wouldn't worship idols anymore? How many times did they promise they wouldn't sin the way they'd been doing? But then the cycle is they would repent, everything was great, and then boom, right back into their sin again. And the fact is, at this point, they were only speaking mere words. Why? They were in trouble. With worthless oaths, they make covenants. God, I promise. And obviously the covenant, the promises originally that they had made to God, that they would obey him, were not kept. An insincere, faithless heart leads to an insincere and faithless mouth. The mouth is the index to the heart. You open a book and you want to find out what's in the book, you look at the index, or table of contents, you could say. But the index of the heart is the mouth. You want to find out what's in the heart, listen to the mouth. If you got a dirty mouth, the problem is not just the dirty mouth. The problem is you're dirty inside. You got a dirty heart. So they speak mere words. The problem is a heart problem. They have a slippery heart. They have an insincere heart. With worthless oaths, they make covenants. They make their promises. The reference to covenants here is not referring to promises made to God, I don't believe at this point, although, as I said, that was true. And I don't think it's referring to them making promises to other countries, although that was done as well. And I'm sure they went back on their promises, for instance, to Assyria. As Leon Wood writes, Hosea here enlarged on the idea of deceitfulness of heart. Promises had been made, false oaths taken, and contracts signed. Though such treaties were being made with other countries, especially Assyria, the thought here mainly concerns agreements among the people themselves. And I think that's what it is. It was true, these other things. It was true that they had made covenants and they were insincere there. It was true that they had made promises to God, which they did not keep. But I think here at this point, I think Wood is correct in that what they're talking about mostly is promises to one another. They'd make promises to one another and wouldn't keep the promises. You know, what a horrible thing. You hear parents do this. My parents were not this way. Growing up, if my parents told me something, you could bank on what they said. Now, that doesn't mean that something wouldn't distract or, you know, something happened, an emergency. And hopefully we understand that, you know. Hopefully your children would understand something like that. But folks, man to man, woman to man, whatever it is, human to human, what do we need to do? We need to keep our promises. We need to be faithful to our covenants. We need to be faithful to our promises. And Israel was anything but that. Israelites to one another, they were not faithful to their promises to each other. You know, today we find marriage covenants, and marriage is a covenant. We find today that promises in marriage are not kept. And we could go on. We have a society today that doesn't keep promises. A society today that will promise you something. Look what happens in business today. People promise you one thing and they don't deliver. We'll have it by Thursday. Sure enough, 2 weeks from Friday, they'll have it for you. I mean, this is typical. Typical in business. People just, you want to hear it? I'll give it to you. And you know this whole idea of breaking a covenant with each other, the idea that they make promises and they don't keep them, not only does it show a lack of respect for each other, but it shows a lack of respect for God. And once again, they do not revere the Lord. They don't revere the Lord. And this is another sign of it. Notice continuing on, and judgment, verse 4, and judgment sprouts like poisonous weeds in the furrows of the field. Leon Wood continues, with the denial of people's legal rights, lawsuits were springing up like poisonous weeds in a plowed field. Talking about the furrows of a field. Notice again, with the denial of people's legal rights, lawsuits were springing up like poisonous weeds. People were not faithful to each other in their promises. And so there were lawsuits going on. They were taking one another to, in a judicial sense, taking them to court in a sense. And because of why? Because there was a lack of keeping their promises. Look at our culture today. You know, we live in a very litigious society. Nothing wrong with that in the sense that we need the courts. It's important to have the courts designed by our founding fathers and designed very well. But the problem is the attitude of the people. You know, today we have parents or kids suing parents, parents suing kids. That's unthinkable. At least in, you know, my generation earlier, it's unthinkable that kids would do that to their parents. But this is the kind of garbage that's out there today. Our own society reflects the sins of Israel here. And then notice first of all, vine, but notice verses 5 through 8, bull. Verses 5 through 8, beginning chapter, or verse 5, the inhabitants of Samaria will fear for the calf of Beth-Aven. Recall what we said about Beth-Aven previously. Do you remember? What does it mean? House of iniquity. Remember, it's talking about Bethel, which is the house of God. And really what God is saying here is Bethel, the house of God, has turned into Beth-Aven, which is the house of wickedness, the house of iniquity. A more accurate name for Bethel, it was not the house of God anymore. So the bull idol at Bethel would be carried away by the Assyrians, causing great fear in its worshipers. I mean, imagine this. Our God is being carried away. Think about that for a minute. Here you're worshiping this idol, and now you're carrying the God away. The inhabitants of Samaria will fear for the calf of Beth-Aven. Their God is carried away. And then it goes on, indeed, its people will mourn for it. Our poor idol, poor Baal. What, you know, why would you pray to something that invaders could carry away? Think about how foolish that is. Think about how foolish it is that we have idols. And I don't mean that we bow down to physical idols of gold and that sort of thing, you know, fashioned into some bull or whatever it is. But we do have idols of gold. We do have idols of money. We do have idols of pleasure that we bow down to, in a sense. We place it before God. It's more important to us than God is. Therefore, it is an idol. And how foolish we are. And its idolatrous priests will cry out over it, over its glory, since it has departed from it. Well, it looks so glorious there in Bethel. It looks so wonderful, this beautiful golden bull. And now they went in and they took it. Not quite so glorious anymore, is it? the failure of false gods. We'll find in our own lives the failure of false gods as well. Verse 6, the thing itself will be carried to Assyria. There are many illustrations in Neo-Assyrian art and literature of the Assyrian army carrying off the idols of their defeated enemies. So this is not something that's unusual. You would expect this, in fact. And they carried the idol away, what? As tribute to King Jareb. Now you say, who on earth is King Jareb? If we translate it, instead of just using it as a proper name, if we translated it, it would come out the great king. And I think that's probably a more accurate translation. I don't think they're intending to make this a proper name. But they're intending here to say the great king, referring to Assyria's king. And Assyria's king at this time was probably Tiglath-Pileser III. So that's King Jareb, or the great king. So the thing itself will be carried to Assyria as tribute to the great king, the Assyrian king. Ephraim, and by the way, who's Ephraim? Do you remember?
Israel.
Ephraim will be seized with shame, and Israel will be ashamed of its own counsel, its own advice, its own plan. They tried to court Assyria's favor, and they tried to form a political alliance, but it will fail miserably. Verse 7, Samaria will be cut off with her king like a stick on the surface of the water. Now, this is a very difficult verse to translate and obviously then to interpret. Samaria, again, stands for Israel as a whole, okay? Samaria will be cut off with her king, now like a stick on the surface of the water. The NIV translates it this way, and I think it brings across the meaning accurately. It says this, Samaria and its king will float away like a twig on the surface of the waters. It's like a swift current, and you take a stick and you throw it into the current, and the stick floats on the top of the water, and the current takes it, and bam, it's gone. Maybe it goes down a falls or something, and the stick is gone. Here's the idea. Samaria is going to, and its king is going to float away like that twig, and then, boom, it's going to be gone. It's going to be carried away. Verse 8, also the high places of Avon, there it is again, the sin of Israel. What was the sin of Israel? Idolatry. That's what he's talking about this whole book. Remember, spiritual adultery. Also, the high places of Avon, the sin of Israel, will be destroyed. We are used to seeing Beth-Avon, but again, this is Avon, or wickedness. But even though it's shortened, it reminds us of the derogatory name that Bethel was given. The house of God became the house of wickedness or iniquity. Those high places where idol worship took place are going to be destroyed. Thorn and thistle, notice that, will grow on their altars. What do you think of when you think of thorn and thistle growing on something? What's that? Yeah, yeah. Did you ever go to ruins of some sort? And I don't necessarily mean ancient ruins, but even modern ruins. In other words, a building that has been abandoned for a number of months or a couple of years or whatever. And you go up to that building and it doesn't take long for those weeds to begin growing. And it shows it's abandoned. Well, here, thorns and thistles, remember those altars? They were excited about those altars. They were multiplying those altars because this is for Baal. And because, you know, he's brought us all of this fertility among our families and among our land, and this is great. And notice what's going to happen. These wonderful altars that they had built, they're going to have thorns and thistles growing all around them. In other words, they're abandoned. They've been carried off into a foreign country. No one's going to be worshiping there anymore. Then they will say to the mountains, cover us, and to the hills, fall on us. Things are going to be this bad during the captivity or during the attack and the captivity. They're going to be so distressed. They would rather have the mountains covering them and the hills to fall on them. It would be so much easier. Does this not remind us of Revelation chapter 6, verse 16? Look at that for a minute. Revelation chapter 6, verse 16. Studied the book of Revelation some time ago. Revelation chapter 6 and verse 16. And they said to the mountains, and of course this is after the sixth seal here in the tribulation period, and they said, those living at this time, they said to the mountains and to the rocks, fall on us and hide us from the presence of him who sits on the throne and from the wrath of the Lamb. So we have the same attitude in the tribulation period. In other words, it's so bad, I just want to be covered up. It would be better to be under a landslide than what is going on. And the Assyrian captivity would be so terrible, so bad, that they would cry out in this manner. Horrible, horrible what would happen. But it's because of their sin. God had created, and we see in the first metaphor, the agricultural metaphor in verses 1 through 4, God had created this luxuriant vine. And they produced fruit, and what did the fruit, what happened with the fruit? Well, they credited Baal with it. And instead of more worship to God, they made more altars to Baal. The richer the land became, the more the sacred pillars grew. Their heart is faithless. And eventually they would have to say, we don't have a king. Why? Because we don't revere the Lord. And then in verse 4, it showed us that they said mere words to one another. They made false covenants to one another. And because of that, judgment sprouted up like poisonous weeds, or the lawsuits did. That's the figure of the vine. And then in verses 5 through 8, we have the figure of the bull there. And it's not a figure. It actually was there. Notice the inhabitants of Samaria will fear for the calf of Beth Aven. And then talking again about the Assyrian captivity. Their God is going to be carried away. Imagine that. Something you worship being carried away. How foolish false gods are, and how foolish they are for us. And I trust as we close this service tonight that you'll look at your own life. Do you have idols? Do you have some things that tonight you are putting before God? Not very powerful gods, you see, when thorn and thistle will end up growing on the altars. Not very wonderful when their worship led to the suffering of the Assyrian captivity and of the attack. Folks, we need to place God first in every area of my life. It was a pin years ago that was worn. It said, Jesus first. It's okay, but I would rather say Jesus everything. In other words, I don't think Jesus Christ should be just first in your life. Some people get the idea that he's first and then, you know, I get him out of the way and then I can start, you know, doing some other things in my life that I really want to do. So I'll just put him first in my life. Understand that Christ ought to be the center of the wheel. That's really the way to look at it. Jesus Christ ought to be the hub of our lives, around whom everything in our life rotates. So is it Jesus first? No, it's Jesus in my home. It's Jesus in my job. It's Jesus. You see, Christ ought to be the hub. And again, all of those spokes in the different areas of our life, all of it ought to rotate around the Lord Jesus Christ. You see, he ought to be the one we worship, not some idol. And again, we may not have a physical idol, but that doesn't matter. There are still things at times that we hold more important than God, and it ought not to be that way.